last time that Camilla Chester came into the studio, she was talking with me about The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox by Maggie O'Farrell, a book which we both loved and we thought that was brilliant writing. So it's quite a challenge to follow that up with something else.
Yeah.
But before we get to that something else, you've also got a book heading towards publication right now, I think, haven't you?
I have, yes. So I write for children. And my second book, entitled Eats, is in the process of being published at the moment, actually. So it should be available to buy end of April sort of time.
And this is for what age children?
Jarred Dreams is for 9+. And this, I think you can get away with it as being slightly younger children. So even 7 might be okay, but it's really aimed at sort of 8 to 11-year-olds.
Now, with your first one, there's an element of mystery or thriller. How would you describe what you're writing?
But the second book is very different. It's much more ridiculous, which is why, and there's humour in it, so it would appeal to younger audience. The first one was a little bit more creepy and dark undertones. There's still a dark twist in this one. I think I'll always have a little bit of that macabre and suspicion going on. But yeah, it's definitely more Roald Dahl-ish, kind of. That's how it's been described.
Okay, well, I hope it goes very well.
Thank you.
And of course, that also leads me to then think, well, maybe that's why you chose this particular title for those of you to discuss, because the book we're going to talk about is At Risk Stella Remington.
Yes.
Now, listeners may recall that Stella Remington was head of MI5 until she retired, and she's now a dame, and she's now writing books. She wrote an autobiography, and now she's written a whole series of crime spy thrillers. She's sort of drawing on her background in the world of spies, in the way that John le Carré did. I mean, he was a spy, I think, for MI6, under a different name, as it were. He changed his name when he started to write. But she's kept her name, and that's quite risky, because one will assume that she's drawing on her own experiences.
Yes, yeah.
It's quite interesting to go back to her history, that she actually sort of seems to have almost drifted into becoming the head of the spies. I mean, she married a fellow who was in the India office. He went out to India. She went out with him. She got a job. Somebody else said, why don't you come and work for me? It turned out he was a spy. And then she ended up in it.
Yeah, interesting background she's got, definitely.
Yes. Mm. So now she's a writer, and she's established a character.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who works for MI5, this woman, this young 30s woman, and she's developed that character over a number of books. I think At Risk, I think, was the first
one. Yes, the first one, yeah.
Am I right to call it a spy thriller, crime? It's not really about crime in the sense that it's a policeman chasing after criminals. This is about terrorists.
But then you could say terrorists are criminals. I would describe it as a thriller, but it has got, obviously, the police spy element in there. But it's perhaps not as fast-paced as a lot of thrillers, though. So it's interesting. It sort of falls in between. And I was interested to reading about her, that she was one of the judges on the Man Booker and was criticised, wasn't she, for assessing books on their readability, which the Man Booker Prize are notoriously slightly snobbish in some ways, we can safely say.
It's the Turner Prize of books, isn't
it? Yeah, it is, really. And so I thought that was quite a laugh, really. And actually, her book was very readable to me. Definitely easygoing, whereas some, you know, more heavy literary works, obviously, are more difficult to read. And this was definitely easy read, really.
I mean, it's a massively popular genre. And there's a heck of a lot of books that are in this style.
Yes.
I've confessed to you that it's not the style that I reach for automatically.
No.
But, you know, I got into it and I enjoyed it as the plot developed, and then I went with the characters.
Mm-hmm.
The principal character, the woman, she's a bit distracted by other issues, isn't she?
You can see she's setting it up for a series, really, because a lot of the elements to do with the main protagonist's backstory and life aren't really featured into this particular plot line, which is obviously that you're trying to get interested in that protagonist, so you're willing to follow other stories with her. So
her erstwhile boyfriend or whatever else will probably reappear.
Yeah,
that'll be an ongoing problem throughout her life.
Yeah.
And she's got a mother that she goes back to visit.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, maybe in the last one she'll go and live with the mother. Who knows?
Make a decision on it. Yeah.
But she's also involved in this sort of patch warfare between she's in one section and there's this other fella in another section.
That's right.
Is this a sort of bit of male-female stuff going on there as well?
I think it's both, isn't it? It's the male-female issue and the power struggle with that, particularly within that industry. And also she refers to them as the fives and the sixes, which it took me a little while to realise what she meant. And of course she meant MI5 and MI6. And there's a rivalry, obviously, between that. And I think that's quite real. It felt very real to me and quite authentic. And I picked up on a few points all the way through that she's known for her openness, isn't she, in terms of the writer I'm talking about, in terms of explaining how MI5 worked, was criticised on that. But that comes across a lot in her book. So if you're interested in the background of how British spy industry works, I think this is quite a good book to pick up, really.
Which is also true of John le Carré, in a sense, because he explores these internal rivalries. And you never know quite who's telling the truth and who isn't.
No, yes. There's more levels to his.
Yes, yeah. I think that is probably true, yeah. There are other characters in here as well. Why are they there? I mean, it's not as straightforward. We can't talk about the denouement. We can't do too much about the plot because we give it away. The essence of a thriller is not to know what's going to happen. But there are various things that happen early on, and that brings in different sorts of characters. And do you think she does that successfully? Do you think these are important?
That was one thing that I've really enjoyed about the book. You've got the two main female leads. You know, you've obviously got Liz, and you've also got the character that is on the dark side, if you like, the terrorist, and she's female as well. But you've also got these minor characters that are playing a part in the plot, but just lift the text quite a lot, and sometimes they give a different tone and style to the books. It's quite nice to just lift you out of the overarching plot and just think a little bit about subplots and what other things are going on and what people are doing in the book, which is quite good.
One of the subplots is about the Cockney guys and them.
They're these Cockney wide boys that are printing up dodgy calendars and things, and then get themselves into this whole different realm and are really out of their league. And you've got this frightened sort of character there as well.
Ken, how many of those mink parfait calendars have we had printed up? On the floor below, his foreman looked up at him. About 40,000, boss. Should be the big Christmas seller. Why? Because, Ken, mink parfait are splitting up. Taking the newspaper, he held it up so that it was visible to the foreman. You sure it's kosher, boss? Not some publicity? Eastman laid the paper down on his desk. Citing personal and musical differences, he read. Foxy Deacon confirmed that the Four Strong Girl group would be going their separate ways. We know that this will come as a shock to the fans, says FHM cover girl Foxy 22. But we wanted to end things on a high. Insiders claim that tensions within the group date from etc. We're not going to be able to give those calendars away. I'm sorry, boss. I don't know what to say.
You've talked about this as a subplot, and those characters are important because they actually provide information later stages. The police have got their finger on them, as it were. They know what's going on.
I like that when she just went into that style and the different speech that they had between them and the banter that they had.
What about some of the more, I mean, they are almost your Cockney end of the scale.
Yeah.
There's also some terribly sort of middle class people.
Yeah, so we've got another character, haven't we? Anne Lakeby. So she comes in with her secretaires all trimming everything, and it's very genteel and brings in a whole different viewpoint of the world, but obviously features in the story as well, which makes it interesting because you're thinking, well, there's a great big spectrum of people there that are caught up into this story, and how is she going to fit in, and what's her purpose? But it, again, it's a different style of text, it's a different style of writing, I like that. I think that's nice.
In her youth, Anne had been described as handsome. With age, however, her long features had contracted to a benign gauntness. Robust and unfussy, a pillar of local charities and good works, she was a popular figure in the community, and there were few events in and around Marsh Creek at which her loud, neighing laugh was not to be heard. Like the hall itself, she had become something of a landmark.
There was a moment when I thought these Cockney characters were a bit sort of cliched, yep. And to some extent also the middle class lady with a secretary is going around the garden can be a bit of a cliche. Do you think she's escaped from that? Do you think it works?
Oh, I think the book is quite cliched in lots of places, but We're so sort of frightened of that, but actually people really enjoy knowing where they are with a particular person and thinking, oh, that's that person, and I know what to expect of them, and I know what the sort of behaviour that's going to come from them. As long as you're not too clunky with it, I think it's okay. And it's not a deep book. I mean, we're not talking, you know, something that's right up there on prize winning. It's just a bit of fun, really, and it's just a good page turner and enjoyable. And if you want something maybe for just to listen to while you're in the car, or, you know, to enjoy when you're on a journey flying somewhere or whatever you're doing, I think it's a really nice thing to be involved in. Yeah,
and you can become a follower of Stella Rimington because she's given you half a dozen or more books that that you can follow the same character, and people like to do that. I recognise that it's not something that appeals to me particularly, but it's very popular.
Familiarity breeds liking, doesn't it? It's a classic thing, and we like to know something we feel familiar with, we feel comfortable with, we know what we're getting, we know what's on the tin. And this is definitely one of those books. You're going to get a good page turner, but you don't expect any like really deep thinking, because it's not going to happen.
A lot of people say thank goodness for that. There are, as you mentioned, the two women. Is she in any way looking at the role of a woman in MI5 or MI6? There's a male chauvinist somewhere.
Well, she's definitely touching on that, but she does it very lightly. She's obviously calling on her own personal experience. It must have been very tough for her working in that world. And I think she uses the character quite skillfully in that way, that she doesn't let her react too strongly. She just brushes things off to do with that world. But yes, she's got this very strong female lead in both areas, so the good and the bad, if you like. And the cloudiness between them, which is what I really liked, is how easily your life could go another way if you've made different decisions. And we've all got this level of darkness within us, and it's just how much it comes out. And she skillfully explains why the terrorist is in the position that she's in. We have quite a lot of backstory about her, and we're much more knowledgeable before the lead spy is, but we're going on the journey with her. She plays them off quite nicely about the way this Liz is trying to get into the other one's head and work out what move she's going to be doing and where she's going to be next, so that she can anticipate that and catch her. She's trying to understand what move this terrorist might make next.
This is not some thrill-seeking teenage bimbo, but a fully trained graduate of the Northwest Frontier camps. If either of the two has made mistakes so far, it's Mansour. He got himself jumped by Ray Gunter and ended up leaving us vital ballistic evidence. And I'll bet you anything you like it was him who killed Elsie Hogan this morning, too. Do I detect a note of empathy there? Admiration, even? No, not an ounce. I think that she's a killer, too, almost certainly.
I didn't find myself entirely unsympathetic towards the woman on the side of the terrorist.
You can feel some sympathy for her and understand a little bit about why she's in the position that she is and how she's making those decisions and what's going to happen, which makes it more exciting, doesn't it? Because you're thinking, is she going to go through with this, or is she going to turn and regret her decision?
As the book progressed, I got more and more involved in thinking there's probably a lot of truth in what is happening here. There's stuff that's going on in our society now that we don't know about, and we're very pleased we don't know about it, but we're very pleased it's being done. We are constantly told X number of plots have been stopped before they've executed, and we have to believe that, but we'll never know. But we're grateful that it's being done.
And I think this book tells you a little bit about the work that might be happening under our very noses.
That's right. Coming to Liz and the character Mackay, they do have quite a few meetings. I mean, he traps her in a sense in a restaurant the first time off for lunch, and he monopolises and takes charge of a situation, or tries to, and she has to fight quite hard against that. So we can't talk about the ending or the final section, because inevitably in these things is either there's no resolution or there's a resolution, and we're not even going to say which it is.
Yeah.
Just in case. So it's basically quite difficult to talk about. But the listener, the reader, has to discover this for themselves.
Although, of course, we do know that Liz carries on to do several more books.
So we know she's alive at the end.
Yes.
And we don't know whether she's in a junior post or a senior post, whether she succeeded. But since we can't explore that area, let's come back to some of the other characters, and one that I know that you particularly liked was this young geology student, Denzel Parrish.
Yeah.
What is it you liked about
Denzel?
Him?
Well, I think it's quite unusual in a spy thriller, or in a thriller. Often they're very dark, not very likeable characters, and you might be reading through and thinking, yuck, yuck, I don't care about any of these people, and who cares what happens to them? Who cares if the world is destroyed? It might just destroy all these horrible characters. But yet here you had this very vulnerable student who was really just trying to get off with some girls, and was coming back to live at his mum's house with his stepfather, and just thinking, oh, he's back from student holidays, and oh, there's going to be no girls around, no, 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 no. And then he had this lovely sort of secret life of enjoying canoeing. He liked to kayak up and down the Broads in Norfolk, because it's all set in this lovely in Norfolk Broads, and I'm actually from Norwich, so a lot of it was quite familiar to me. And then you can just see him, you know, paddling gently down, looking at birds, and it made him seem so vulnerable. And then of course you've got a character that you care about and that you want to see something nice happen to, and yet he's in this horrible spy thriller thing going on, and you know he's going to be caught up in some dark way. And so when he becomes potentially under threat, you're like, oh, and then you're more engaged in the book and in the story. And I like that. I like to have a character that I care about, and I think, no, they're innocent, they don't deserve to be wounded in any way. So it's just a personal thing, really. Some people care about that, some people are not bothered.
Well, let's end with an extract about Denzel Post. Thank you very
much. Lovely. Thank you.
The knackered old Honda Accord wasn't exactly what you'd call a babe magnet. But then, mused Denzel pessimistically, rural Norfolk wasn't exactly troubled by a babe overload. The problem, for all their geniality and likability, was the Americans. There were hundreds of them, mostly single young men, and they had nowhere to go off base in the evenings except to the local pubs. West Ford was several miles from the nearest base, but you still got a handful of them at the George most evenings. And while this was fine in itself, it meant that a single impoverished geology student didn't stand a great chance in the event of a halfway decent-looking girl fronting up there.
Our thanks to Caliber Audio for allowing us to use the extracts in this discussion of At Risk by Stella Rimington. The audiobook was read by Maggie Mash, and the recording lasts for 16 and a half minutes. Caliber Audio is a specialist charity providing talking books to those who, for any reason, are unable to use the written text. For more information, see their website, caliber.org.uk. The music accompanying this edition of the Talking Bookshelf is called Good Times. It was composed and recorded by Goffby of Kenilworth, who's very generously given us permission to use his music.